Hello, Dave.
Good morning, Ed. How are you doing?
Darn good.
I'm
Darn good.
glad to hear it. Did you get your project all wrapped up last night?
No, actually, I'll be working on that for a couple months probably, but
Oh, long-term thing.
yeah, I'm doing some work on national security policy, especially nuclear non-proliferation stuff.
Oh, yeah. Little
So
beyond my pay grade.
yeah.
That's interesting. So do you have a little bit of time now to talk, or?
Sure do.
Okay, great. I've got you on record right now, by the way.
Okay.
So what generally what we've been doing is just kind of a it's more of a one-sided conversation. Once in a while, I'll ask you questions if something comes to mind. What I've decided to do, I'm going to edit some of these conversations down for use in the second part of the DVD, but there's also been an interest expressed in having a complete collection of conversations. So I'm thinking of perhaps, in fact, very likely producing a set of CDs that have all of the interviews in their complete state, with very little editing, so that because there's just not going to be physically going to be any way to put these even edited conversations into a DVD because there's just going to be too much information.
Sure,
And
sure.
in fact, Tom Spencer thought it was important that this stuff be archived because it's the source and we're the sources and if once this if this thing isn't done now, chances are it's not going to get done. We keep losing people,
Have you ever
unfortunately.
talked with the Military History Institute on this?
No, I haven't. I should look into that and
Yeah, you certainly should talk with them and see what they might be doing, what support they might be able to give, what interest they would have. And if this stuff is going to be archived anywhere, it ought to be archived with them, because if anybody's looking for anything like this, that's where they're going to go.
That's a very good idea. What did you call it, the organization?
Military History Institute.
Okay, I'm
I
making notes.
think there was an Institute of Military History or something like that at Carlisle Barracks. And as far as I know now, there's a group like that on Fort McNair. In fact, I'm going to be in and out of Fort McNair probably a number of times in the months ahead. And I'll make a point to stop by
Well, that would be
and
great.
put them in touch with you.
That would be fabulous. Be very interested in talking to them. Like I said, this what I'm hoping to do is get enough conversations done in the course of the next month so that I can finalize the editing on the DVD portion and have that available around the 1st of April. But I'm sure that there are going to be other people that I won't be able to get in touch with in that time frame, and so I'll continue with the project, and certainly invite everyone who was a member of the mission who has something interesting to contribute, and work on that end until it's complete,
Well,
So.
they might have some helpful suggestions for you also on how to go about interviewing and so on. Because those guys have been doing this from a military history point of view, for years and years.
That's a
I have
great
one other
idea.
general question,
Sure.
too.
Okay.
So far as I know, all of this stuff has been declassified.
Right. That's my understanding as well from everyone that I've
Well,
talked to.
that's something you really need to be careful about, because some of the things you're liable to get people talking about, maybe they haven't been declassified.
Okay.
We did some work, for instance, with agency assets, looking at, say, nuclear capabilities. My guess is that none of that is declassified. you mentioned the VRN stuff. I imagine that's all unclassified now. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the work I did with that was at the Intel headquarters in Heidelberg. And exactly what's declassified there, I don't know.
Okay.
So I think you really need to talk with someone on this that really knows what is and what isn't.
Do you have any recommendation in terms of who I would, what agency or how I would go about doing that?
Well, the organization itself may know a bit on that because, of course, they've been posting a lot of stuff on the mission website. Mm-hmm. And all of that's been formally declassified. So I would expect that Bill and the people that have been running the organization have some idea. Mm-hmm. The military history people would also, I'm sure, have some idea what to do on that.
Okay. Okay, I'll certainly follow up on that before anything is released. Because,
you can get us and yourself in a ton of trouble if we go stumbling into areas that we're just talking about that really haven't been declassified.
Right. Well, before anything's released, I'll certainly follow up on that and ensure that all this stuff is available for release. Generally, what we've been doing is I just have the person introduce themselves by name, when they served, what capacity they served in, who was chief at the time, and then just kind of get into some memorable experiences. I know that if I'd be interested in hearing your general memory or impressions of the Larkspur, or you were involved in that, weren't you?
Not really.
Or was it, okay, Sand Dune, I guess would be.
Yeah.
Anything else that really comes to mind that was, and it doesn't necessarily have to be operational, it could be just general impressions, personnel you worked with, or whatever that, you know, might come to mind, but very, you know, casual type of conversation.
Okay. I'm Ed Corcoran. I was a major at the mission from 72 to 74, following on 2 years of assignment in the Intel section at USARER headquarters in Heidelberg. I was an ordnance officer, and specifically there was an ordnance or tech officer slot so that there would be somebody there with really equipment expertise on the mission staff. I was basically a tour officer and probably spent, I don't know, two-thirds of my time there on the tour status, and the rest of the time, of course, working reports and so on in the headquarters. So,
you, I'm just looking through the unit histories, seeing where your name comes up. Let's see here. It talks about several tours that you were on when there were some types of incidents. One notes when you and I believe it was Sergeant Kreutz were in some type of a little bit of a pursuit with an UAS-69, and it mentions that the warrant officer in charge suffered a cut lip. I was curious as to, did you punch him?
Nose, I think. Huh?
Did one of you guys punch him, or did he hit the dashboard? Or how would that have happened?
I'm pretty sure that's the one where we were sitting in a wooded area watching a sort of secondary road that we thought might get some military traffic. A couple hunters came by us, and we decided that probably wasn't a good idea, that we should be a little more careful and maybe get out of there. And about that time, an UAZ came steaming down the main road, spotted us in there, seemed to turn in after us. So we turned and just moved away pretty sharply on some of the wooded trails. And a short while later, as we were coming in a little intersection of these trails in the middle of the woods, the UAZ came shooting out from the left, and I guess it was a bit of an accident. I'm not sure if he hit us. I think he hit us a little bit, but everybody came to a really rapid stop. And yeah, the warrant officer that was in the UAZ ended up with a smashed lip or a nosebleed or something from where he'd hit into the dashboard or the front of his, the inside of his own vehicle.
I guess they weren't wearing seatbelts either at the time.
No.
Which we never did. I don't even remember if we had seatbelts in the car.
No, I don't ever remember using seatbelts.
Yeah, we just held on tight to whatever was available. I would also be interested in hearing about what prompted you, or I guess what was the revelation that caused you to come up with the idea of going through trash? Weren't you involved?
Well,
you were kind of the individual that kind of prompted that activity.
Well, there had always been a little bit of sporadic collection of trash. And all of these military facilities had trash dumps around the outside. And there were some records in the mission of where some of these trash dumps actually were. And basically, they were pretty accessible. And if you got into them at 4 in the morning, first light, you were very unlikely to have anybody else stumbling on you there. And there was always an assortment of sort of interesting stuff. We would find, for instance, tons of newspapers and things like that. There was a sort of confidential, limited distribution newspaper, mm-hmm. a daily newspaper, as I remember, that GSFG put out, Krasnaya Zvezda, I think, Red Star. And it would talk a bit about GSFG operations and what was going on, and that always seemed to be a nice little thing to provide the intel people with if we ran across it. And we'd pick up odds and ends of military-associated equipment. I remember one specific one. It was a sort of padded, a quilted jacket that I found and brought back. And I remember Otto Cheney, who was the ops officer at the time, really hitting on me for it. This stinky, smelly, terrible thing, but we included it in a box of odds and ends that we sent back to Intel. And when their report came back on the box that we'd sent, they said the only thing really of interest in there was this padded quilted jacket. So they sort of liked it. But it was always sort of hit and miss. There, we didn't find, real military secrets there. But we did find stuff that helped give us a bit of a better understanding of what GSFG was doing. And it was an easy thing to do. If you were around a facility at 4 in the morning, to stop by their trash dump and see what was there. So I started doing more of that, and I think the people after me did more of it too, because what we got out of it was useful. It wasn't amazing stuff, but it was interesting and gave us some more perspective.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Another thing that I remember you being intimately involved in was the collection of VRNs. And I was curious, since that was a time, at 72, early 70s, when computers were not readily available, at least at our level. I'm sure DOD probably had some type of a system, whether it be a card reader or something that they were using. But how were you able, methodology would you use to go through the organizational aspect of collecting that and assimilating all of that data?
That started when I was at the Intel shop in Heidelberg before I came to the mission. I came to the mission, I don't remember exactly, I guess the summer of 72. And several months before that, like it must have been the beginning of 72, the Soviets redid their VRN system and gave everybody throughout GSFG a whole new set of these vehicle registration numbers, these license plates. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like since they were redoing it and starting from scratch, it was a good time to start up a collection and analysis effort. And we had a computer center with the Intel people there. And so I worked with them and just set up a very simple input system where we took about, I don't know, 5 or 6 data elements, you know, a date and time, a VRN number with numerical coding for the typically the 2 Cyrillic characters on the license plate, and then a location of the sighting and a set of comments. So there were only about 5 or 6 data elements. We set up a one-line input on the typical input sheets, data input sheets you'd have then, and they were probably key punched and put in cards. So basically what we had was just a large database with the VRN numbers and the locations and the sightings and so on. And at the time, I asked MLM and through the U.S. mission, asked the French and British missions to please collect and note down as many VRNs as they possibly could so that we could get a good feel for what the patterns were. And after doing this for several months, just get out a simple printout that showed the listings of the VRNs by number and where they were and so on. And it gave us really a nice insight to the organization of the forces, because they had them broken out that certain sections, certain parts of the VRN numbers went to certain armies and certain ones went to certain divisions and so on. A bunch of them went to, of course, the GSFG headquarters troops. And so after a while it got to where just by seeing a VRN, we had a pretty good idea what unit, at least what larger unit it came from. It also gave the Order of Battle people a good opportunity to look in some detail at the organization of the different units, because with a listing of what the equipment was by type, you could pretty much tell how many of this type or how many of that type the unit had, how many jeeps, how many trucks, how many ambulances, what have you. So I think in the long run it got to be quite helpful. That had just started when I went, got transferred to the mission. And it seems to me, after I'd been there several months and we had a quite large quantity of these VRNs in our database, I put together some of the initial analytic reports on how these VRNs grouped and what they belong to. But generally, as you know, the reports that came out of the mission weren't analytic at all. They were just reporting data, what we saw, where we saw it, and so on, and left it up to the analyst to figure out what it meant. So for a while, I did a little analytic work on the VRNs, but of course, that was really, the analysis was really the responsibility of the units we were reporting to. And so after a while, I think I pretty much left it to them. Mm-hmm. But it was an interesting and I think very useful effort on our part.
Mm-hmm. I recall running the columns with the, as we used to call it, passing convoys with the
sure.
cassette tape recorder running and rattling off as many numbers and vehicle idents as we could. Was kind
yeah.
of a standard thing that we did after you came, I recall. Made the job more interesting and certainly had to be on your toes a little more because in addition to making sure, ensuring that they didn't try and clobber you or run into you while you're running columns, you're also involved in being able to ID each vehicle as you went by, sometimes at fairly high speed, in order to collect all of that information. So that was an interesting part, I think, of the daily aspect.
I remember that too, how difficult it was when you were passing a column head on, for example, and each vehicle is just sort of whizzing by you for a split second to try and say what it was and what the VRN was on that one before the next one came by. And then trying to make sense out of your more or less garbled transcription as you went by the column.
Correct.
But I think that turned out to be a very useful effort for the intel people, and it gave them stuff to match up with other things in terms of what unit structures were like and so on.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall if we ever determined that there was any, I don't know how you call it, cross-trading of equipment between units or various, you know, organizational things where they were shifting vehicles around, or were they generally assigned and stayed in one place, or was that impossible to even tell from that process?
Well, you couldn't really tell from that process because if they switched the vehicle to a different unit, of course, they'd switch the license plate.
Right.
But there were a number of other efforts going on. For instance, there was what they called a box body effort, and there was a whole unclassified handbook of the different types of van or enclosed trucks. You know, we would see a typical truck on a transport, but then there were probably 100 different kinds of trucks that had an enclosed body of some sort on the back. And they were classified by the type of, we called them box bodies, the numbers of windows, the numbers of openings that they had on them. And there was a real effort to try to decipher what these different ones meant. So, for instance, there's certain kinds that you would always see at, say, a communications site. There were certain kinds that seemed to go with maintenance units. And if you had a VRN on a box body, it very much helped tie it to a specific unit and helped identify what that particular box body was. And so this, the box bodies, several of them were really key parts of the unit. So critical communications vans, for example. And by first of all figuring out who they belonged to and getting a better handle on how many of them there were, because over time as you collected the VRNs, you could see whether a unit had two of these or maybe six of them, just by the patterns of the license plate numbers. So it was these sorts of things that were helpful. If you had, for example, a bridging unit, you could get a better estimate of the number of bridge sections that the unit had by the VRNs on those trucks. So if that series of trucks ran from VRNs ending in 30 to VRNs ending in 80, you knew you had more or less 50 sections. And if you ran a column and you got most of those numbers, but number 38, 39, 62, 63, and so on were missing, you could sort of figure, well, they must be additional bridge section units that for one reason or another weren't there on that day. And maybe the next time you saw the column, you'd see those numbers, but some others would be missing. So it would let you over time build up a really good estimate of exactly how many, say, bridging units or bridging elements were in that particular unit.
I recall whenever a mission would go or a tour would go out, we were always on the hunt for something new and exciting to see that no one else had reported yet. Does anything come to mind of something that you might have come upon that was new and extraordinary?
Well, a lot of times on the new and extraordinary stuff, we would have some sort of tip-offs from the headquarters that, for instance, a new type of artillery piece was being introduced into the units. And on the basis of that, a lot of times, we'd sit, for example, on a rail line somewhere, expecting that a rail shipment of this new type of equipment would be coming by sometime during Wednesday afternoon or something like that. And work, of course, to try and get both account and good photography on the stuff as it came by. Occasionally, we would run into something on the road that we'd never seen before or that struck us as really unusual or a strange type of variant, a new box body, for example. And, of course, whenever we did that, we'd do our best to get as much photography on it as we could. So there was always little things being upgraded. Maybe the kitchen trailer that a support unit was pulling along or something like that was different. And of course, that was one of the things we always looked for was modifications or changes or upgrades or something new.
The vast majority of both troops and equipment were moved into East Germany by rail. And it always amazed me that seemed to be a little concern on the Soviets' part if they were to bring some new piece of equipment in that they would bring it in untarped.
Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. It depended on the equipment. And, of course, for some things like a new type of artillery piece or something, even if it was tarped, just getting the count of how many pieces there were and getting good shots on the outlines would be helpful. But yeah, a lot of times it wasn't tarped. And of course, I think if you just think about it, trying to keep something well tarped on a several thousand mile rail voyage is probably a bit difficult because just because of the elements and it's probably logistically a bit of a problem to provide lots of tarps for lots of something every time it moves and so on.
That's a good point. Of all of the tours that you are out on, does anyone come to mind that was truly exciting or that you were wondering whether you're going to get out of a situation or whatever like that? Close calls, I guess you would call it. Does anything come to mind where you were kind of shaking in your boots a little bit?
Well, of course, the one time we were shot at certainly comes to mind.
And who was your driver?
John Bainey.
Oh, were you with him with the bullet in the boot deal?
Yep.
And he ended up
with, yeah. We were outside an East German caserne. And by and large, I think the East Germans were touchier than the Soviets. But we were outside an East German caserne on a little roadway around the outside of it. I was standing up on the hood of the car trying to take some pictures over the wall of what was inside. And it was a real misty morning. And all of a sudden, from out of the mist up ahead of us, an East German sentry sort of materialized. So I hopped down and back in the car. John Bainey wheeled it around the 180 to take off. As he's wheeling around, of course, I'm looking out the right side, and I'm seeing this guy drop to his knees and start aiming at us and start popping off shots, and we roared off in this hail of bullets coming back from behind us. Well, I don't know about a hail, but probably a dozen shots. And as we were leaving, probably 100 yards ahead of this, there was a regular crossroad. So we came off the little dirt track behind the caserne, running across this local highway. And as we're crossing the highway, as we're coming up to it, and as these bullets are flying, some poor little East German car comes putting right through the middle of all of this. But we ended up with a couple bullet holes in the car, and one round, as you mentioned, in John Bainey's boot. I had always thought it was in the heel of the boot, but the last time I saw him at the reunion, he had the boot with him, and it was in the toe of the boot. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, we were clearly lucky on that one.
Yeah.
So there were a few bullet holes in the car, and then that was it.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you, and I think the East Germans were a little bit more trigger-happy than their counterparts. I recall being up, we were somewhere near the Polish border, and peeking into the window of a building that we weren't quite sure what its capacity was or who was in it, and out comes a East German dressed officer, it looked like, with a hand pistol or a handgun, and started popping some rounds off at us as we were fleeing the area. So, yeah, they tended to draw and shoot, draw down a little quicker on you than the Soviets did, although there were several situations, I recall, where Soviet sentries generally running up on them in a training area would tend to either fire a warning shot or maybe even a shot in your direction.
Sure, and of course Nicholson was killed by a Soviet, so.
Correct, yeah. And so that did happen.
Yeah, it sure did.
Is there anything else that you that comes to mind that you might want to add to our conversation? I know we've covered some real interesting topics.
Well, of course, some of the real interesting tours were when you actually ran into something. I can remember sitting along a riverbank watching a river crossing exercise, and then being chased by an UAS. In fact, I think that particular time we ended up bogged down in some soft ground and being hauled into the Commandatura.
That was with Rookie Rogers, I believe, near Elster Galeen.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And then I remember another time we got out in a farmer's field, and it was just complete muck and mud, and we ended up being able to power our way through to like a little barn area. And the next thing you know, we're sitting next to this barn, and it was sort of like a little island in a sea of mud. And so we decided, well, we can't just sit there forever. We're going to have to try. And so we did our best to roar our way out of that, but we ended up really bogged down in the mud. Had a farmer hunted one up. He pulled us out to right near the main road. And about that time, some East Germans or Soviets, I guess Soviets, came up and detained us, more or less. So we were sitting on this road. They had the exit off this farm road over a ditch. They had the exit into the local roadway blocked. And so I remember looking at it and thinking, well, maybe we can do something here. I think Charlie Kreutz was driving. So I said, Charlie, I'm going to go over and talk with them. And while I do, I want you to start the car up. And I'm going to go over and insist they let us go. And, of course, they're not going to let us go. But while I'm insisting, it would make sense that you start the car up. And then I'll take a look at that ditch while I'm out and see what we could do. And so when I got back in, I said, you know, Charlie, it looks to me like we can make our way through that ditch. And, of course, the car was running, and they weren't particularly expecting anything. And so all of a sudden we burst down into the ditch. A couple guys sort of jumped on the car to try and hold it back, but we were actually able to power our way through the ditch and get up on the roadway and get out of there. So that was satisfying. But, you know, there were always times like this UAS in the woods that we hit, like when you're sitting on a rail line and all of a sudden there's cars rushing at you and you're rushing to get away. That was one reason I did so much work late at night and early in the morning, because it gave you an opportunity to drop off any tails that might be following you. So my general procedure was I like to be able to travel for an hour or so after dark, because then it was pretty easy to lose anybody that might be following you and to position yourself so the next day when you moved out you were pretty confident that you were clean, that there was nobody right behind you. And, of course, that's particularly true because, as you know, we could turn off the rear tail lights, which made it harder for anybody to follow us. And when we got into quiet areas, we could also cut down to maybe just the parking lights or maybe even no lights and use the night vision goggles to travel some distance. So I found that traveling an hour or so after dark and then squirreling away in a real quiet place that was close to where I wanted to be the next morning worked out really well. And, of course, the other thing that worked out well was to be moving more or less at first light, because a lot of times that was maybe 4 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And at 4 in the morning, you could pretty much go wherever the hell you wanted to, and nobody was going to be noticing you. So that was a real good time to move around on training areas, for example, to come up to the fence of a concern and take pictures, to go into a trash dump, really to do pretty much whatever you wanted to. That time of the morning was relatively easy.
And I think that's why you had the nickname Captain Midnight, which was which you were well known for that. And actually, from an operational standpoint, it was a great idea to do that. I think maybe some of the other officers didn't like to arise so early, but you could get the goodies.
That was the times when the opportunities were there.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. Well, this has been a real interesting conversation. I think we've been able to touch on some interesting topics. Do you have anything else you'd like to contribute before?
Not right now, Dave, but okay. You can think it over, and I'm going to be on the computer quite a bit in the months ahead.
Okay.
And with Skype, if you see me online, ring me up, and if I'm free to talk, we can talk, and if not, at least I can give you a suggestion on when would be a good time to try again.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
And like you said, I do appreciate if you, when you're at McNair, if you could look into that. And I will do some research on this end myself for, in terms of contacting the Military History Institute or finding
out. I think if you just Google them, you'll find some stuff. And some of the people at the mission Burhan's or whoever's running it now, Tom might also have some ideas too.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure I saw a military history section of some sort the last time I was on McNair. So I'll look for it the next time I'm there and let you know.
Sounds great. Well, thanks a lot for sharing with us, and hopefully we'll be talking again in the near future.
Okay. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Ed.
Bye.
Bye-bye.